Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
So, folks, thanks for coming along tonight, and Bridget Griffin-Foley makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She was here about 5 or 6 years ago on the occasion of another book, and this time she's here on the occasion of the publication of Changing Stations, the story of Australian commercial radio. So I'll introduce our speaker briefly. Bridget Griffin-Foley is the ARC Queen Elizabeth II Fellow and the Director of the Centre for Media History at Macquarie University. She's widely recognised as Australia's leading media historian, and she's the author of, among other works, The House of Packer, The Making of a Media Empire, Sir Frank Packer, and Party Games, Australian Politicians and the Media from War to Dismissal. And it was on that occasion, the third book, that she spoke here. But tonight, Bridget Griffin-Foley is here and to talk generally on the issue of changing stations and Australian commercial radio. You're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard, and for the invitation. The title of my talk this evening is Dial in Democracy, 40 Years of Talk Back from Andrea to Kyle. I'm going to begin with a quote. You know, it's fine for you to carry on here as though climate change is a hoax and anyone who believes in it is an idiot. In that case, the whole world is run by governments led by idiots, fumed Malcolm Turnbull in an interview with Alan Jones. Sydney's breakfast radio star might believe that human-induced global warming is a hoax, but his exchanges with Turnbull had been heating up. For months, Jones had been needling the opposition leader over the issue of an emissions trading scheme, or tax as Jones preferred to call it. By the 3rd of November, Turnbull was no longer prepared to attempt to placate the bombastic 2GB broadcaster. The pair traded blows and talked over each other, with one ABC commentator subsequently remarking that the jock had been shocked by Turnbull's bravura. After Turnbull attempted to push an ETS agreement through the Liberals' party room last Tuesday, Sydney's top-rating commercial AM station joined, perhaps led, a campaign to stir up the Conservative heartland. Chris Smith, the host of Afternoons, and Jason Morrison, the host of Drive Time and Jones' heir apparent, urged listeners to let senators, particularly in New South Wales, know what you think about the carbon tax. Senators' contact details were published on 2GB's website. According to one report, a backbencher received a phone call to his office every 30 seconds. Last Friday, Jones's show conducted a poll with the question, should the federal opposition be supporting the government's ETS legislation? 97% of the respondents reportedly said no. That morning, Tony Abbott was interviewed by Jones and declared his intention to challenge for the leadership if Turnbull did not reverse his support for the ETS. By last Saturday, all the hot topics and video comments on Jones's webpage concerned the ETS. Smith's webpage published a kilometre of atmosphere, why an ETS is nonsense, failing to acknowledge that the equation had first been brought to the attention of Australians by 4BC's Michael Smith and the Herald Sun's Andrew Bolt, a vocal climate change denier and a regular guest on Jones's program. Talkback radio has been big news this year. Before the Alan Jones and 2GB meltdown came Kyle and Jackie O's stunt with a lie detector, in which the teenage interviewee claimed that she had been raped. This episode in August led to Kyle Sanderland's suspension from Austereo, followed by another shortly afterwards. When the Australian Communications and Media Authority launched an investigation into whether the commercial radio codes of practice needed to be tightened to protect members of the public taking part in live segments, the industry's peak body, Commercial Radio Australia, tried to insist that programs produced with a 7-second delay didn't actually constitute live radio. In this address, I'm going to present a short history of commercial talkback radio, discuss the nexus between talkback radio and politics in the 1960s and 1970s, and consider the maturation of talkback radio and its role in Australian politics. Running throughout the talk tonight will be the figure of the Golden Tonsils, John Laws, who began his radio career as a 20-year-old on 3BO Bendigo in 1955 and retired in 2007. Controversy has long dogged Australian talkback radio. Indeed, before 1967, the recording and rebroadcasting of telephone conversations was illegal. Since the 1920s, the Postmaster General's Department had forbidden any broadcasting of messages that might compete with postal and telegraphic services. In the 1950s and 60s, Australian commercial radio executives, some of whom had studied the success of conversation programming in the United States, increased their lobbying efforts to build audience participation centred on the telephone into programs to compete with the threat of television. After the beeperphone, which allowed telephone conversations to be recorded and put to air with a short delay to prevent the broadcast of offensive remarks, was introduced to Australian radio in 1964, the files of the Australian Broadcasting Control Board bristled with sharp assessments of what individuals and topics could legitimately be heard on air. Broadcasting conversations with unseen telephone callers whose bona fides have little chance of being properly assessed was thought inappropriate. Airtime should not be given to irresponsible and poorly spoken individuals like Fred of Coburg. The topics discussed on Norman Banks's I'm on Your Side, including happy marriage and birth control, did not merit serious consideration as news. In the first half of the 1960s, listeners to 3AW and its sister station in the Macquarie network, 2GB, could hear new recruits like the journalist and socialite Andrea Dorothy Gordon Jenner. Market research showed that her program was almost a substitute for a daytime serial and appealed most to people over 35. She and her counterparts, Eric Bohm, Carolyn Bernstein and the young John Laws, were, in the Bulletin's vernacular, talk jockeys, occupying a middle ground between established radio news commentators, disc jockeys and talkback hosts. Another former newspaper journalist, Ormsby Wilkins, worried that the Top 40 format had turned commercial radio into a jukebox for the kids. He was broken in at night on 2UE, where he learned to attack, to arrest the listener, to take a stance. Each year, 6KY presented What the Announcers Think, with hosts encouraged to vent their feelings on whatever took their fancy and argue among themselves. After relentless lobbying by the commercial radio industry, the PMG's department announced that the recording and rebroadcasting of telephone conversations would be allowed using its equipment from the 17th of April 1967. Such was the associated hype that the telephone lines of one capital city were jammed after midnight. The Broadcasting Control Board's officers hoped that talkback would contribute to the diversity and entertainment value of programs if it was suitably serious. Norman Banks, well-balanced intelligence secretary, was said to assess the suitability of callers, weed out people who might be host callers, and seek a balance of views. Officers monitored the program to ensure that the panic button was effective and that sensitive subjects were handled responsibly. Gimmicky teenager participation was disliked. John Laws, who hosted Party Line on 2UE, was criticised for allowing a call from a young boy to initiate a discussion about suicide and for taking a call from a woman who seemed to be under the influence of alcohol or drugs. However, there were already signs that broadcasters and their management saw opinionated, at times hectoring styles, as good for business. By June 1967, Macquarie's 6IX was promoting itself as adults only, daring, provocative, controversial, revealing. In 1968, Laws admitted that his rudeness was deliberate, explaining that his show had died in its first few months because he had been too patient. "Now I tell people to go to hell." When John Pearce took over mornings on 2GB that year, he adopted a Mr. Nice Guy persona in contrast to Ron Casey on 2SM. But after Pierce lost patience with one caller calling him a damn bore, he was summoned to an executive's office and told that they were onto something. Pierce was transformed into one of the most curmudgeonly talkback hosts on air until his death in 1996. Really good station personalities in conversation radio, remarked 2GB's astute general manager, Des Foster, were exceedingly rare. A solution for some stations lay in poaching established personalities. In 1969, for instance, Ormsby Wilkins was lured from 2UE to 3AW. Soon after, Laws also left 2UE, joining 2UW on $50,000 a year for 5 years. So to move on to early talkback and politics. As the title of Wilkins' program on 3AW, Powerline, suggests, there was always a close nexus between talkback radio and politics. Two premiers were at hand just after midnight on the 17th of April 1967. Sir Henry Bolte took calls from Pat Jarrett's listeners on 3DB, and R.W. Askin was heard probably on 2UE. Talkback arrived during a transitional period in Australian politics. The long Menzies hegemony, which had come to an end the previous year, was followed by leadership instability. A series of stories and issues made Canberra news more prominent. After Prime Minister Harold Holt disappeared in December 1967, Barry Jones conceived the idea of having the leadership aspirants appear on his 3DB program. With Jones' guidance, Senator John Gorton, whom he had known for years, came over as attractive and direct, while the other candidates appeared to be pompous or equivocating. Wilkins boosted his own profile and bargaining power in 1969 when he played on air recordings of his telephone conversations with Prime Minister Gorton following an incident with the visiting American singer Liza Minnelli. That same year, with American stations favouring hard news over heartline talkback, Des Foster and the experienced broadcast journalist Brian White devised an innovative format for the latter's afternoon program on 2GB. The compere was to dial out to key figures on the issues of the day, and the show would behave more like a newspaper. Newspaper journalists came to recognise the need to monitor today with Brian White's penetrating but sometimes light-hearted look at politics in case a politician made an important statement. Talkback radio quickly attracted political indignation. In 1968, Labor's Senator J. Hay Mulvihill complained to the Broadcasting Control Board that Andrea had indulged in a farrago of nonsense about Whitlam's relations with South Vietnam, and he demanded a right of reply. Nevertheless, a study commissioned by Labor in 1971 showed that women, in particular, were greatly influenced by talkback. At the very time the ALP was seeking to exploit talkback's utility, it was resolving that a fairness principle should be incorporated in broadcasting legislation to enable opposing viewpoints an opportunity for expression. With debates underway about matters such as the long overdue introduction of FM radio and the possibility of a Labor victory in 1972, Commercial Radio Australia's predecessor, FARB, developed a fairness code for broadcasters. The fairly anodyne document was produced in 1973 and promulgated by FARB as a PR activity. Smaller parties also took radio seriously. Before the 1972 election, the Democratic Labor Party dissected Melbourne's radio ratings, determining that morning talkback programs on 3AW and 3DB appealed to about three times as many women as men. Gordon Barton's Australian Reform Movement also worked the medium keenly, especially in Sydney. John Laws himself was becoming more interested in politics, guided by Ben Chifley's former press secretary and the 2UW news editor Don Rogers. Although no socialist, Laws felt that Whitlam played the media brilliantly, emerging as pro-radio and pro-me. At around the same time, talkback radio began attracting scholarly attention, although there was little consensus about the genre's merits. In 1973, a postgraduate student, Rosemary Creswell, reported that Senator Doug McClelland had his press officer listen to all Sydney talkback shows for the 5 weeks of the election campaign. The staffer's assessment was not encouraging. Trivial issues attracted most interest, and the hosts were misinformed and misleading. Creswell herself was perturbed to see some stations describe callers as a beautiful piece of copy or bad material. A contemporaneous academic assessment was more positive. Don Aitken and Anne Norrie estimated the audience for open line programs in Sydney as 200,000 in the mornings, so one third of the total Sydney radio audience, with women constituting two thirds of the callers. They were impressed by the volume of political discussion and talkback's capacity to provide a means of direct access to people in power. Some talkback presenters, like an earlier generation of commercial radio news commentators, including Colonel J.M. Prentice and Charles Cousins, tended to infantilise their listeners and callers. The notion of the talkback host as a kind of ombudsman developed early. Norman Banks, who had presented shows like Voice of the People and I'm on Your Side before venturing into talkback in Melbourne, referred to his audience as the little people. The biggest shock of his life had been discovering so many little people who simply lacked the knowledge, confidence, courage, and/or initiative to stand up for themselves and deal with officialdom, he wrote. According to John Laws, callers became more articulate and thoughtful as talkback developed. Talkback programs were never far from controversy, adding to the commercial radio's sense of siege during the Whitlam years. In 1973, the Liberal Party's John McClay referred to them as wretched programs, while Labor's Laurie Wallace maintained that programs in their home state of South Australia were invariably anti-Labor. During the 1974 federal election campaign, Joe Biocchi-Peterson used The Premier Speaks, his weekly program on 4BH, to slam the ALP, leading to the angry young Labor MP for Gympie to demand and receive a right of reply on a Macquarie affiliate for GY. Women hosts were involved in some of the biggest radio contretemps of this period. In 1974, 4BH's Gabby Horan, a member of the Liberal Party and president of the Queensland Housewives Association, resigned in protest at the station's decision to give a right of reply to the Federal Treasurer, Frank Crean, following remarks she had made about taxation. Claudia Wright brought to 3AW the same bravura that had cost her a position on the Melbourne Herald. She aggressively interviewed politicians and captains of industry and broke new ground in discussing feminism, civil rights and the environment. In addition to her own morning program, Claus had a daily dust-up with Ormsby Wilkins and Norman Banks that was compulsive listening for many Melbournians. Former Prime Minister Menzies, who was a frequent target of Wright's vitriol until she quit the station in 1977 following a spat involving the Catholic Church, abhorred her. The potential for stacking talkback lines was increasingly obvious. Doug McClelland, now Minister for the Media, thought that if stations were unwilling or unable to check the identity of callers against the telephone number given to the switchboard operator, callers should have to identify themselves on air. The anachronistic requirement in the Commonwealth Election Act of 1918 that callers be identified was rarely invoked, although it did cause problems for the radio industry during the volatile 1975 election campaign. In 1987, Parliament finally legislated to remove the requirement. In 1975 and 77, Malcolm Fraser used talkback extensively. It allowed politicians to ignore difficult questions, focus on matters they wanted to raise, and refer to notes in front of them. Announcers were usually also less aggressive than print journalists. While one such journalist lamented that talkback radio had become the town meeting of our times, albeit a largely menopausal one, a coalition government minister, Senator Rex Withers, waxed lyrical about talkback's vital role in our democratic processes. The ALP's powerful New South Wales branch set out to cultivate John Laws. Neville Wran and his press secretary, Brian Dale, made sure Laws got good stories and controversy. So to move on to more recent talkback developments. It was not just the ALP and Bob Hawke, but John Laws who emerged victorious from the 1983 federal election. The core celebs of the campaign were gaffes by Malcolm Fraser, who advised startled listeners to put their savings under the bed if Labor were elected, Paul Keating and Andrew Peacock on Laws' program on 2UE. As Laws began referring to talkback as dial-in democracy, the broadcast media monitoring industry took off. It was the Hawke government which finally removed the 72-hour pre-election blackout on election commentary on radio and television that had irritated the radio industry since the 1940s. Talkback's increasing role on the airwaves, with talk merchants now hosting shifts of up to 5 hours a day, and in politics, led to analysis and complaints. 33% of respondents to a study on the foreground factor commissioned by 6PR claimed to listen closely to talkback, compared with just 6 to 16% to music programs. A considerable portion of an extant compendium of complaints handled by the Australian Broadcasting Tribunal between 1984 and 1987 pertained to talkback and allegations of rudeness, bad language, bias, and derogatory remarks about Aborigines. Race was now a hot-button topic for talkback hosts. The most provocative was probably 2KY's Ron Casey, who in a heated interview with former South Australian Premier Don Dunstan in 1981 had remarked that Asian immigration should be monitored. By 1989, Casey had been suspended and a panel operator sacked, following comments about Asians, Aborigines and multiculturalism. The ABT ordered 2KY to publicly reprimand Casey for two breaches of the radio program standards and to use a 10-second delay and employ senior staff to monitor the program. It was not long before Casey left the station. There were other controversies. On 3AW, Darren Hinch's crusades, mostly concerning pedophilia, not only helped him earn the human headline label, but contempt of court convictions. In 1986, it was revealed that the Minister for Immigration and Ethnic Affairs, Chris Herford, had written to Jeremy Cordeau at 5DN, offering to break stories on matters like budget issues and ALP discipline, in return for a quid pro quo such as a regular time slot in my own city or a larger audience with, say, John Laws. In Sydney, Laws' photograph was hung at the Machiavelli restaurant, a rare honour for a non-politician. Politicians thought that being called a friend by Laws was helpful, as was being invited on air to lunch. Laws' good instincts and deceptively lethal style could entice politicians to drift into dangerous territory, as Treasurer Paul Keating found when he warned that Australia was in danger of becoming a banana republic in 1986. An opposition leader, John Howard, discovered when he triggered a debate on Asian immigration during a 1988 interview. The more stories Laws broke, the more politicians clamoured to be on his program. Although the Liberal Party could not match the Reserve Bank briefing Keating arranged for the self-confessed economic dunce, Dr. John Hewson, shadow treasurer and then opposition leader, used Laws' program to try to soften his image. Howard went on to use talkback radio like no other Prime Minister. In 1996, he announced the Coalition government's revamping of the immigration program on Alan Jones' program. He launched his 1998 re-election campaign on the same 2UE program. Afterwards, he established a studio in his Sydney office to easily chat with stations around the country. That election also elicited speculation that Jones's support for Pauline Hanson had done much to build One Nation's support. The Cash for Comment scandal of 1999, in which presenters at 2UE, 3AW, 5DN and 6PR were accused of entering into commercial agreements with sponsors in return for favourable editorial comment, did not deter politicians from appearing on talkback programs. Since the days of Barry Jones on 3DB and Douglas Darby on 2GB, the careers of Australia's politicians and talkback hosts had been overlapping. Presenters who went on to elected office included Jones, the Reverend Fred Nile, Stephen O'Doherty, John Tingle and Ian Cameron. Once their political careers were over, Graeme Richardson, Peter Anderson and David Oldfield tried their hands at talkback. Darby, Jeff Kennett and Kerry Chigorovsky moonlighted on radio while still in Parliament. Kennett, who had led the Liberal Party in Victoria, ushered in the 1990s by moonlighting as a summer host on 3AW. In January 1990, he devoted one broadcast to conducting an interview with himself on whether he still harboured ambitions for the top job. This piece of vaudeville, surely the most mischievous use of talkback by an Australian politician then or since, was enough to persuade many that Kennett was merely biding his time. It was hardly surprising that some presenters were drawn or headhunted to politics. Hosting talkback generally involved holding firm views and being articulate, persuasive and high profile. Alan Jones, whose bid for Liberal Party pre-selection failed, operated somewhat differently. In 1999 alone, the self-styled champion of Struggle Street dispatched 4,500 letters, many on behalf of his listeners, to those in authority. Although politicians such as Mark Latham privately fretted about the need to handle AM radio's opinionated talkback hosts, few challenged them publicly before Malcolm Turnbull. In the build-up to the 2004 election, Latham, now opposition leader, preferred light and fluffy FM sessions to talkback. He was wary of being trapped by hosts who regularly talked to Prime Minister Howard and feared that talkback would be stacked with Liberal stooges. He had at least some cause for concern. Early in the campaign, a call to a Perth station about Labor's tax policy was exposed as emanating from a Liberal Party member. Late in the campaign, a satirist from The Chaser made a spoof, pro-Liberal call to Alan Jones. Latham's successor as opposition leader, Kevin Rudd, cultivated FM and its younger audience during the 2007 election campaign, in which Howard's age was an issue. In Melbourne, Rudd fronted Nova 100's breakfast duo, Husey and Kate, and in his hometown of Brisbane, he dealt with the wheel of inappropriate questions on Labrat, Camilla and Sab's program on B105 FM. So to conclude, Australian commercial talkback radio has survived a string of controversies and debates about the presenters' sponsorship arrangements, their influence on political and policing matters, their specific role in the Cronulla race riots of 2005, and their general role in multiplying a culture of complaint. Some of the rhetoric and commentary about talkback radio, such as the term shock jock, has been rather indiscriminate. Talkback has different genres on the AM and FM bands. AM talkback radio is not as uniform or as predictable as some suggest. Besides, just what constitutes talkback radio? Politicians often appear on the programs of talkback presenters such as Alan Jones, Neil Mitchell and Howard Sattler, without actually taking calls from listeners. A study by Stephen Crofts and Graham Turner found that Jones talked more than his callers and took the least number of calls of the talkback hosts they examined. When the Australian drug dealer Van Nguyen was on death row in Singapore in 2005, Jones, Neil Mitchell, Mike Carlton, John Stanley and Steve Price were amongst those to oppose the execution, defying the expectation of a law and order agenda on the part of commercial talkback hosts. The controversies of recent months involving Kyle Sandilands and Malcolm Turnbull point to three continuing threads in the 40-year history of Australian talkback radio. The first concerns a debate about what members of the public can or should be heard on air. But while the Broadcasting Control Board's views on the suitability of topics and voices for broadcasts in the 1950s and 60s seem paternalistic, if not elitist, it is difficult to see some of the stunts involving FM callers and competition entrants in more recent years as anything other than exploitative. The second continuing thread involves TalkBack's role in political communication, with politicians present at the inception of commercial TalkBack radio, and now recognising that TalkBack is part of an around-the-clock media cycle. The third raises the question of whether TalkBack hosts, for all their boasts, and callers should ever really be equated with public opinion. If, as the saying goes, failure is an orphan and success has many parents, Australian TalkBack radio might be thought of as a bastard child. Its birth was troubled, its parentage uncertain. An ambivalence about TalkBack is evident from broadcasters' own reflections on the genre, which transformed not just news and current affairs on Australian radio, but sports, religious, health and gardening programming. John Pearce takes credit for bringing back from San Francisco the idea of two-way radio. However, Barry Jones regrets his pioneering role in a genre which, he says, has declined remarkably. Buzz Kennedy, claiming to have been on 2UW, the first TalkBack host in Australia, is an even less doting parent, writing, "What a terrible thing to do, and I am ashamed." Thank you.
Many thanks. Janet Grundy's got copies of Bridget Griffin Foley's Changing Stations outside, so when you answer that call, we'll be away. So we've got till 7 o'clock. Monitoring the print media is difficult enough, but it's there. It's in libraries and some of it's increasingly online or digitalised or whatever, but monitoring radio, and especially commercial radio, must be extraordinarily difficult. There's a lot of detail in your book, but how did you get across all this detail?
You're not talking so much about formal media and monitoring as such, but more about the history of the industry more generally?
No, it is how you write the book.
How did I write
the book? Just come back here.
How did I write the book? It was quite a challenge. I started it nearly 7 years ago and didn't expect to take quite so long. I've tended to write in the past about what might be thought of more as the tabloid or the commercial media. I think that scholars have probably tended to take broadsheet newspapers which have been indexed, or a public broadcaster, the ABC or SBS, somewhat more seriously. It seemed to me that commercial radio was the big void in the area of Australian media history. It was extremely difficult to write. I talk a little bit at the start of the book about attempts that can be traced back actually to as early as the 1930s to write about the history of commercial radio, and I think there are, as Gerard's indicated, some fundamental problems. There are 261 commercial stations in Australia, and there is no one central archive. The National Film and Sound Archive, of course, has some terrific material, largely, obviously, audio-based. In terms of tracing documentation concerning developments in the Australian industry, developments concerning ownership, advertising, regulation, new programs, the moves of personalities, that has been extremely challenging. Thankfully, I managed to trace through the sort of bowels of assorted archives quite a lot of archival material. There's radio and broadcasting periodicals. The records of the Macquarie Network survived in the John Fairfax archives. Unfortunately, those archives, I understand, are now under threat. And I also did attempt to do a survey of every radio station in the country. I wrote to every one asking me to advise them if they had any archival records and what they were like. And I got a reasonable response rate to that, so I found myself traipsing around the country everywhere from Geelong to Innisfail to Launceston to Perth. I've sort of been almost everywhere. So it's a real national story, but quite a difficult one to write.
It's hugely difficult.
The need to entertain and to be a shock jock is obviously part of commercial talk about radio. How does it work for women, though? The minute women get too hard or too grumpy or whatever, they're not popular. So what's the rules for women as a shock jock? And I notice we don't have very many.
That's right.
Cool. down to the end of the ramp, yeah.
Yes, you're quite right, Anne, that the rules are different for women. I do trace in Changing Stations some early women hosts who did do fairly polemical talk or talkback radio. I look at the figures of Andrea and Claudia Wright and Gabby Horan. All of them faced real difficulties doing talkback radio. Andrea was found to be too volatile and unpredictable. So although a camera crew from the ABC was actually there in the studio to film her being one of the earliest women talkback hosts in 1967, within months, the talkback component of her program had been removed. So basically, she would respond to issues on air, but she wouldn't take calls from listeners. She wasn't the only woman to be taken off air in that way. Dita Cobb, who filled in for Andrea while Andrea was on holiday, talked on air about sex scenes in movies. So she went from air. Claudia Wright had a spectacular blow-up with the Catholic Church and, as I indicated, left 3AW before she was sacked. And Gabby Horan also resigned in protest, as I talked about in relation to an episode at 4BH. So I think you're quite right. The rules for women are different. There were a number of women in the 1960s and 70s, but they generally haven't lasted. There were also debates, of course, about women's voices. Going back to as early as the 1930s, there were discussions concerning whether women's voices were too light to be on air and whether station executives were saying they were much better suited to sort of, you know, heartline, midnight to dawn, soothing broadcasting rather than to more sort of contentious news-based formats. That's something that Anne Deverson found really infuriating when she was at 2GB in the 1970s. When Gwen Plum was on air at 2GB and news of, I think it was Nixon's departure came, she wasn't allowed to actually put that story to air. It was a male broadcaster who actually went on air with that story. So very different rules.
Ida, and then we'll go here. Yes?
I wonder if you could comment on the Australian model of talkback radio with the British and American models.
They're reasonably different. Obviously, in Australia, we have what's called a dual system of broadcasting. So when it was established in the 20s and 30s, it was seen as being the public broadcasting sector was seen as being modelled on the BBC, so the ABC supposedly drew its inspiration from the BBC. The commercial sector drew its inspiration from the purely commercial sector in the United States. So really, in terms of talkback, there's not a lot of synergies between talkback in Australia and in the UK. And indeed, I mean, a whole other story, which I don't tell in this book, but other historians have, is the ABC's response in Australia to talkback. They were much slower about sort of embracing the possibilities of talkback and thinking that that was a really sort of viable, potentially attractive media form. And the ABC was even more cautious than the commercial sector about putting the voices of ordinary people to air. So there was a considerable discussion with or debate within the ABC about what were known as actuality broadcasts. There are more synergies between the commercial sector here, the commercial talkback sector, and the United States. I think, however, in relation to talkback, it's probably fair to say that while figures such as Laws and Jones have been or are important, I think, politically, they don't have quite the reach that people such as Rush Limbaugh have in the United States, where there are, you know, networks with literally over 1,000 stations. So I also think the notion of hate or outrage radio, which really emanates from the United States, hasn't been embraced quite so fully in Australia. And that's why I'm even a little bit wary. I didn't quite, when I was doing this rather wide-ranging book, as Jared suggested, ever managed to trace exactly when the term shock jock started being used in Australia. I think it was in the late 1980s, but I don't think the shock jock here is quite as outrageous, or deliberately outrageous, as he is in the United States.
I just wanted to ask you, what's been the enduring effect of the Cash for Comment scandal on commercial radio, and you spend a lot of time in the book talking about that? And
I certainly do talk at some length about the Cash for Comment scandal, which hasn't, which, as I mentioned, was first exposed in 1999, but it's been a sort of a continuing saga, and we've seen Media Watch in particular exposing further examples of personal endorsement agreements in return for favourable comment in more recent years. I guess there's been a couple of legacies. One is obviously to completely tarnish the reputation of the commercial radio industry. When I have spoken to people over the last few years and they've asked me what I'm doing and I mention commercial radio, the two things, especially as I work in an academic field and a lot of my colleagues say I only listen to the ABC, but if they think about commercial radio, I suspect they think of shock jocks and Cash for Comment. So I think the episode has had a really sort of unfortunate legacy in that sense. In a more practical way, though, the commercial radio code of practice was changed to try to prevent some of these practices, but there are loopholes. We have seen... I'm conscious of the fact that this is being recorded. I have seen... There has been some controversy about whether endorsement agreements are actually between individual broadcasters or between actual broadcasting companies and sort of third-party organisations. So that is a loophole that some broadcasters have been able to use. I was doing an interview with a commercial radio station in Perth last week, and he was basically fuming to me about the actions of certain on air about the actions of certain commercial broadcasters in Sydney, and talking about the impact that they'd had on people such as himself, who had to declare everything on air and on the website, from, you know, almost what brand of underpants he had to wear. So it's interesting to see that some slightly more isolated broadcasters have really felt the impact of this.
Next question. Yes.
Hi. It's interesting that the talk today was labelled "Dying Democracy." Often, a consequence of democracy is that majority can stifle a minority. And I wonder what your view is about the multicultural voice when it comes to talk back radio. How it's going to evolve in the future.
Yeah. One of the interesting aspects of the history of commercial radio in Australia is that from the 1940s to the 1970s, commercial radio did offer a voice to migrant communities. There, I briefly trace in this book quite a history of what was called foreign language broadcasting on the Australian airwaves, particularly, obviously, after World War II, there were programs designed for Italian, Greek, Maltese listeners and so forth, and even for some smaller ethnic groups. Commercial broadcasters by the 70s were starting to withdraw from that field because the industry was becoming more competitive. The sector felt that it really needed to define its station image, whether it be in the era of talk and or music. And what was known as foreign language broadcasting, unfortunately, didn't quite fit in. So these programs largely disappeared from the commercial airwaves and found a home on the emerging community radio sector. In terms of the issue of multiculturalism and talkback radio, it's fair to say that the issues of race and immigration, multiculturalism, have been really contested ones on the commercial airwaves. There's been some fairly controversial broadcasters in this area, as I've suggested. And, you know, there have been accusations of vilification. It is actually very hard to sort of prove vilification, as you probably know. So in terms of that area of talkback radio, that is, I think, one of the probably less savoury aspects of commercial radio. And I think you're right, this notion that a number of major talkback presenters peddle of them being, you know, the voice of democracy, the voice of the mass, the voice of the silent majority, does mean that more marginal voices are sort of stifled.
There's a question down there. Yeah.
In your research, have you worked on a relationship between advertising revenue and the level of controversy created by different media?
Not explicitly, but one of the points I think I should have made in relation to the question of, you know, the legacy of cash for comment is the issue of the live read. As early as the 1930s, within one of the, you know, in growing commercial stations in Sydney, 2UE, executives were actually saying that it was inappropriate for announcers to directly sort of advertise programs, but not advertise products, particularly in a conversational way. It's interesting that 70 years later it would be the commercial agreements at that same station, 2UE, that would promote, that would provoke the cash for comment inquiry. One of the legacies of cash for comment could have been banning the live read. This is something that Mark Day, the media commentator for The Australian, has talked quite a bit about. That hasn't happened. So the live read does draw in considerably more higher revenue than pre-recorded advertisements. So having a more sort of conversational, sort of editorial endorsement brings in more money for the broadcaster and for the station. And that, of course, is a practice that, that has not ceased because of cash for comment.
Mr. Heath.
Yeah, in a recent Andrew Olley presentation by Julian Morrow, he talked about secondary outrage, which is the use of the internet to rebroadcast things that were on radio or TV to be seen by a lot wider audiences that were originally anticipated for. So therefore, the original target market may not have been outraged, but the secondary one, who may be an older generation or a different group, may be totally outraged. Mm. How do you compare this now, where you've got a situation where you have one group of people, which was Sanderland's defence, which is... my group weren't outraged by what we were doing, mm. but this broader community are.
That's a really challenging question, and Gerard alluded to the difficulties of writing a history of commercial radio, particularly when, you know, the voices are broadcast into the ether and they tend to disappear. I mean, very, very little has survived, but we are now, of course, in an era of media abundance where quite a bit of material does survive on the internet. I mean, you can go, if you want to the to assorted websites and hear the audio of the Turnbull Jones exchange, or you can go and get the transcript from the web. Interestingly, the transcript of the particular one, the really controversial one of a few weeks ago that I referred to, actually aren't on Turnbull's or Jones's website, whatever that says. So, yes, I think this material surviving does open up the potential for possibly unintended consequences, but that is something that's incredibly difficult to trace. I mean, I've found it difficult enough to trace the outputs of 80 years of programming, so now to think about... I guess when I started this project, people probably would have thought, how do you do it? Because there's no archives, in a sense. Now it's almost like one of the potential problems could become for anyone wanting to write about the media in Australia or elsewhere is that there is too much information. All I can say, I guess, is watch this space, and that's something that's going to have to be considered by writers on the media. And writers on radio are going to need to think about not just radio, not just as a kind of auditory or oral form, but as something that could come with visual content through digital radio or through the internet, and also written content in the form of the transcripts as well.
Yes. Look, two questions. Do you have any reason you hypothesise as to why national networking of radio shows hasn't been successful in Australia? I mean, TUE with Lord especially tried regularly to get his show networked across the eastern seaboard. And secondly, on the related issue of the climate change meltdown on TalkBack, that seemed to be a Sydney incident, yet we've had a national consequence. Are you aware of whether there was a similar meltdown in other geographies, or has it just been the members from Sydney who've been affected?
I guess to tackle those questions in reverse order. I looked most closely at Alan Jones, I guess partly because I was actually hearing some of these broadcasters last week. It seems that badgering the senators, particularly in New South Wales, I think does seem to have had some further national resonance. I think the positions of some particular senators in New South Wales were actually quite crucial to helping, promote this push against Turnbull's leadership. What was happening in other states, I'm not entirely sure. I suspect there may not have been what seemed to be a really sort of concerted campaign on the part of 2GB and its lead broadcasters. Interestingly, Ray Hadley in Mornings wasn't quite so much a part of it. I'm not aware. It would even just be interesting to have a look at other affiliated stations such as 4BC and 3AW to see what they were doing. So that's a good point. I might actually think about that. I actually intended to start this talk tonight talking about Carl Sanderlands, but I ended up following the thread of the political events of the last week. So in reverse order, your other question concerning national networking. Look, there's been attempts off and on for 70 years to develop national networks. Some have been more successful than others. One of the sort of notable experiments that failed was, I think it was called CBC, the Consolidated Broadcasting Corporation, in the 1980s, which was a Kerry Packer initiative to syndicate programs between 2UE and I think it was 3AW in Melbourne and other stations. That didn't work, partly because, particularly in relation to breakfast programming, people in Sydney don't want to hear about a traffic accident in Melbourne, for instance. So there's really sort of fundamental issues such as that. However, it's not really possible to say that networking has failed completely. There are some major radio networks in Australia. Macquarie Regional Radio Works, for instance, has, I think, about 60 affiliated stations across the country. There are some FM comedy duos who are heard in more than one city. So I'm thinking of Merrick and Rosso, for instance, and Kyle and Jackie O, I understand. And there was one other example I was going to use, which I've forgotten. So it's difficult, but in terms of sort of economies, major media groups that have moved into commercial radio are managing to do some things, and they're using technology insert local advertisements, for instance, to try to create an impression of localism. And my other point did actually concern John Laws. While he was never the voice in Melbourne that he was in Sydney, he did actually have a considerable national presence in the last years of his career. He was heard on over 50 stations, not always the whole program. Sometimes it was just an hour or 2 hours of his three-hour shift. But and those programs could be, interrupted by local advertisements and local news.
Thank you.
And Laws would record some. Sorry, Jared. And Laws would record some advertisements because he was, you know, the most fantastic advertiser and, you know, live reader of advertisements. So, you know, he could advertise anything anywhere, and he did.
Mark Carlton used to do live reads in between moralising about commercialisation.
That was something else.
That was different. Okay, final question. 7 years, 8 years doing this. What's next?
My next project is, having moved from sort of press to television to radio, is to do something called a companion to the Australian media. We don't have one history of Australian journalism or the Australian media. So what I'm attempting to do in this is to produce a large sort of, I guess, one volume encyclopedia, which will have entries and essays about pretty well all aspects of the Australian news media going back to 1803. I'll be writing a number of the contributions myself, but I'll be functioning as a sort of commissioning editor and editor of contributions from a range of people, including some people I have no doubt in this room.
Many thanks. Take a seat.
Thank you.
Well, I'll be very brief. I regard commercial radio as very important. I didn't only just listen to the commercial read from Mike Carlton to find out what I should be buying, but also the content. Commercial radio is obviously very important. I'm also a great admirer of Professor Griffin Foley, because it's great to see a university academic in the field of media who's actually talking about real people and real radio stations and real events and does enormous amount of empirical work, which we can all use. And I think this book is a huge achievement. It's taken a long time, but it is a huge achievement. We got a sample of that tonight. And as I said, there are copies of the Changing Stations outside. Professor Griffin Foley's paper will be up on our podcast tomorrow. It will be published in the Sydney papers online. There will be some copies of the book also available on our web tomorrow. But for tonight, thanks for telling us about your enormous achievement in such a brief and timely fashion, which up to date to the events of this current week, which is quite an achievement. So well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.